This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the SportsMap Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. Home loans that fit your life. Rocket can.
And Real Ketones Keto Energy Shots.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Oh, good morning. It is a Thursday on SportsMap Radio. It is Wake Up Call. Tony D. Ron Culver out today. He is on a wedding trip out to California. I hope he comes back okay. I mean, you never know. Now traveling is kind of a little bit more dangerous than it's ever been. But nevertheless, I was actually kind of surprised last night there wasn't an NFL football game. I was kind of like, oh, yeah, we've been moving games all over the place. Will there be a Wednesday night affair? No, but there isn't going to be a game tonight. All the games are going to be Sunday and Monday. COVID has really shifted around a lot of different things. But there were two baseball games yesterday. Oh, I should say there was a baseball game, and then there was baseball being played and finishing out, if you will. The Tampa Bay Rays and the Houston Astros game, that went down to the wire. The Rays had a runner on third, the tying run in a 4-3 game with two outs, and the Astros avoided elimination last night. And they beat the Rays to extend their series to a game 5. Rays still lead 3-1. But the Dodgers-Braves game, that was over immediately. Like the Braves did in their game 5 matchup with St. Louis last year, they gave up a bunch of runs in the first inning as if to signal, we really don't want to be here today. The Dodgers scored 11 runs in the first. 11 runs. Kyle Wright was the starter. He only lasted 2/3 of an inning. He gave up 7. And then the reliever came in, Grant Dayton. He came in, he gave up 8 over his work. So the Dodgers put up 11 runs, and that game was finished. Max Muncy hit a grand slam. Max Muncy hit a grand slam after they had already scored a whole bunch of runs. That's how bad the Dodgers put a beating on the Atlanta Braves. Nevertheless, the Braves take a 2-1 series lead into game 4. So yesterday was one of those times in baseball where two teams won. In the Dodgers, not so much a must-win situation, but certainly don't want to go down 3-0. In the Houston game, it was absolutely right against the wall. Had to win, elimination game. Two different methods of managing and two different methods of holding on and getting a victory. Talk about what Dusty Baker did for the Astros next as we continue with Wake Up Call. Plus, we got some college football COVID news to get to and some other news in the NFL as we roll along on a Throwback Thursday.
Listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. Home loans that fit your life. Rocket can.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Tony D, Ron Culver out today. We continue on a Throwback Thursday. Rick Ashley in 1988 we go back to, because on this date in 1988... the LA Dodgers beat the Oakland A's in Game 1 of the World Series 5-4. If you're a baseball fan, you know how they did that. If you're not a baseball fan, I will tell you how they did that. Kurt Gibson, who was not in the lineup because of a pulled left hamstring, hobbled to the plate in the bottom of the ninth inning and hit a home run that won it for the Dodgers. And everybody went crazy because he barely could get around the bases. He just kind of hobbled up there, took a swing, hit a home run, and that was it off of Dennis Eckersley, no less, who nobody was hitting off of. But what was interesting about that World Series, it was like very heroic and it was very Hobbs-like from The Natural and whatnot. It was that the series had an it's over feel to it, and it was just game one. I mean, the A's were a juggernaut baseball team, and yet there was a feeling of, oh, this is going to happen for Los Angeles, and they did. I mean, they had Earl Hershiser and whatnot, but still, they ended up pulling off the five-game win against the A's in that series, winning it in five. And I thought Oakland was a better team going into that series. They were really powerful. They had the Bash brothers, McGuire and Canseco, and, of course, Eckersley coming out of the pen. And the Dodgers ended up winning, and the heroics of Kirk Gibson on this date in 1988. So speaking of baseball, so yesterday the Astros went on and stayed alive in their series against the Rays. although I still think it's inevitable that Tampa Bay wins the pennant and goes on to the World Series. But the Astros have made it interesting, a 4-3 victory over Tampa Bay. Bob Nightingale at USA Today talks about something that was in that game that was the key to the Astros' victory, which at the time made, it was like the sixth inning, and it made sense. But still, you knew the Rays still had some firepower, but one of the turning points of the game, or one of the moments in the game that stood out to him, was Dusty Baker just going on instinct rather than using these sort of algorithms to figure out when he should be pulling pitchers and when to make changes and whatnot. Zach Greinke on the mound facing Randy Arozarena, who already homered in earlier, and he has been red hot in the postseason. It was number five in the postseason for him. But the Rays were threatening. Arozarena was at the plate. There are two outs, and Dusty Baker goes to the mound to talk to Greinke about this. Now, remember last year, Greinke got pulled for Will Harris in the World Series. Harris gave up a two-run homer, and Washington went on to win the series. Greinke, in talking with Baker about this, were they going to go to Ryan Pressly of the bullpen? Was he going to be able to come out, get Arozarena out? Or was Greinke able to do that? And Baker, in talking to his players, had a feeling of trust that Greinke was going to be able to do that. Going back to the dugout, let Greinke stay in the game, and sure enough, he did. He got Arozarena to strike out, and then later on got Brasso out as well, and the Rays' rally was cut short. The Astros did hang on to a 4-3 victory. Rays did threaten in the top of the ninth inning. They had a runner on third base. That was the tying run of the game, but they were able to get out of it and secure the victory, and we go on to a game number five. Again, I feel inevitability that the Rays are going to pull this out, although with the Astros lineup and how good they are, all right, if they get it to a game seven, all right. I mean, I really am not surprised by anything, but I think this Tampa Bay team, this is, if you're going to lose a game, lose it like this when you had opportunities with your bats to put runs across the plate. Now, the Dodger game is the exact opposite, because the Braves took a 2-0 lead, and they did so by basically shutting down the bats of the Los Angeles, which was surprising given how powerfully offensive the bats are for the Dodgers. Braves, on the other hand, just did it with pitching, right? They got great outing from Max Fried, they got a great outing from Ian Anderson, and the bullpen did the rest in getting the Braves those victories. But the Dodgers scored 11 runs in the first inning. Now, imagine if you're on the Dodgers, and you know you have firepower. You know you have a lineup that is able to score and score quickly and put up runs. They hit a ton of home runs in the 60-game schedule. I think they led majors, or at least were close with the Yankees, for the most home runs in baseball. And you know you have anywhere in the lineup, you can get guys on base and you can get them home. You're not doing that in this series, right? There is a mental aspect to this that kicks in. Right? Maybe this team has our number. Why are we not being able to do this? Now, imagine if you're in the dugout now, right? And you put up 11 runs. You won 15-3. You're going into game four. How different is your mentality now? You didn't have your back against the wall, but you don't want to go down 3-0 against a team that seems to own you. You don't want that. You don't want to go down 3-0 and feeling like you're not being able to produce what you normally do. And you've heard the cries before about, here are the Dodgers again failing in the postseason. Here are the Dodgers again failing in the postseason. And now it's a different series. It doesn't matter in the end if you lose by 10 runs, 3 runs, 1 run, 100 runs. It doesn't matter. It's a game. It's a game. If that game was 14 innings long, then the Dodgers won. It's still the same outcome as we get today. Mentally, though, it's a totally different aspect. You know, Muncy's hitting a grand slam. You got back-to-back home runs in that game. I think it was Peterson and Rios hitting back-to-back home runs in the first inning. You tagged that pitching staff. Now, we know this in baseball. This is the one thing to consider, though. One thing in baseball that we know is that your momentum is only good as the next day's starter. But you got to think in Los Angeles right now, the Dodger clubhouse and the Dodger hotel room in Arlington, that there is a feeling of, okay, we got over the hump. That we've been stagnant offensively, and now we've taken care of that. So no matter who they throw at us, there's enough confidence that we can put runs across the board. Let's see if that plays out, right? Let's obviously see if that plays out and the Dodgers do tie the series and this becomes more interesting. I think in the Tampa Bay Astros series, I think the Rays, again, as I said, are going to win the pennant. I think in the end, they're going to be able to take a game out of the next three. The Rays are just a pesky team that doesn't seem to go away, even when you feel like you've got them beat. Like I said, that moment that Dusty Baker says, hey, you know, you're going to go in there, you're going to get this kid who's absolutely smoking hot right now at the plate. I mean, five home runs for a rookie. Five home runs already in the postseason. Already at home run in the game. To get him out, that's a great feel-good moment, but the Rays didn't go away after that. It's not like the Astros then tagged on three or four more runs and just kind of cruised to victory. They still had to sweat this thing out, and I think the Rays know that. So I'm glad the Dodgers won, and I'm glad the Astros won. I didn't want sweeps, and I didn't want these two very, very good baseball teams to have not shown up in the NL and ALCS. I mean, especially the Dodgers. The Dodgers are the best. Were the best team in the National League, and if they were getting quieted by the Braves, I think we would have been missing something. Right? Sports seems to be struggling for attention amidst this incredible election, but it would have been a shame not to have seen the Dodger bats at least show up once in this series. Maybe not a heavy dose of it, like 11 runs in the first inning that makes most of America go, "All right, we'll see you whenever you're playing again. Thanks." But it is good to see the Los Angeles be Los Angeles. I mean, this is what they do. I mean, they score runs and they can really pop at the plate. Now we've got a different series and a different narrative to this. ALCS is now just survival. That's the way it's going to be. So instead of a back and forth, you win one game, we'll take the next game. You win the next game, we'll take the next one. You've got basically a good Astros team, a team that's not as strong as last year, but still strong and nevertheless always having their backs to the wall. Every moment is going to be calculated into how do we figure out how to not lose this game. We gave up three runs. We got to get it back or we're out of the postseason. One bright spot for Houston, which I thought was good because of what happened in game three. Jose Altuve, whose throwing error opened up a five-run inning for Tampa Bay in game three, drove in two. Had a home run and an RBI double in the game. So a little bit of redemption there. Yet they've got to get Altuve mentally back. So I'm glad, at least glad that that happened for them. So that is the wrap up of the Major League Baseball AL and NLCS. It's two totally different games in terms of outcomes, but two situations that have been better for these series in that the team that was trailing, the team that sort of needed to win, won those games. And we're going to extend this just a little bit more. All right, coming up, COVID has struck college football. One coach is going to be out, a major deal coming up on Saturday. I'll tell you who that is next as we continue with Wake Up Call.
Is Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Hey, don't let a bad battery leave you stranded. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts can test your battery free of charge, and if it needs to be replaced, O'Reilly Auto Parts can help find the exact battery for your car or truck at a guaranteed low price. Keep your car on the road by getting your battery tested for free at O'Reilly Auto Parts. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. In excess, 1988, we go back. The Gibson home run in the 1988 World Series. Dodgers beat the A's. A's a better team than the Dodgers that year, but L.A. would win it in five and win the championship. That was the last World Series title for the mighty Dodgers. But Curt Gibson setting the tone with a pinch hit home run, hobbling to the plate with a hamstring injury and hit a home run off Dennis Eckersley, of all people, on this date in 88 on a throwback Thursday. All right, Saturday's huge college football game has number 2 Alabama hosting number 3 Georgia. Nick Saban will not be on the sideline. He has COVID-19. So Steve Sarkisian, and what a run he has had, is going to be setting up the preparation for the Crimson Tide this week. Saban is going to communicate from his home. He's in isolation, but Sarkisian is likely to be the guy on the sidelines. It's going to be the interim head coach while Saban is out. It's interesting because this is, like, again, one of the bigger games in college football, and you want Nick Saban there if you can get it. Now, I know some people don't like Alabama, some people don't like Nick Saban, but I hope we can all root for his recovery during COVID-19. But the virus has affected the SEC again. Maybe not this game in terms of its of playability. They're still going to get that one in Tuscaloosa, barring any further positive tests within the team. But LSU had and Florida had their game canceled in Gainesville after an outbreak of the coronavirus within the Gator football program. This is now the second game this weekend for the SEC that is going to be postponed. And I know the pundits out there who were really skeptical of college football playing this year really are looking at this now going, see, look at this. Houston has hardly played a game. Now the SEC has been affected. You got all these other games postponed. The Big Baylor's got a problem. Big 12 is moving games all over the place. Yeah, but everybody knew that was going to happen. I know it's easy to stand on the pedestal and look down and say, I told you so. But you're not really, I told you so. Because I think everybody within the sport of college football anticipated that there was going to be some games that were going to be affected by this virus. Look, the NBA worked because it was in a very strict bubble. The NHL worked because it was in a very strict bubble. Major League Baseball pulled it out, but they had a lot of games canceled because of it. Now, a lot of games postponed, I should say. Some games canceled. College football knew this. The commissioners and the university presidents knew this. They knew that in the end, these are college kids. This is a college environment. We can have virtual learning, but in the end, this was going to be an issue. We were going to have some outbreaks and some teams were going to be affected by it. That's why they built in the ability to play games later and postpone it. And we also came to an acceptance that some teams were going to play 10 games and some were just going to get in 8. That's just the way it was going to be. There was some higher thing that they were looking for. They were trying to save other programs. They were trying to, you know, continue with revenue that they were going to need from the athletic department. So there wasn't this feeling of, well, universally, we're all going to play the same games, right? Because it's going to be fair. This is one of the most unfair ways to conduct a playoff that we have in sports. We have a group of people sitting in a room deciding who the best 4 teams are. Right? National championships have been decided in that room. There have been really good teams that have been left out of the process, and there have been teams with questionable records who have been put into the process. Right? There's no standard. You know, you can win your conference and not even get into this thing. So you've already have some sort of subjective avenue to determine who is going to participate in the championship. And even before that committee, it was all subjective as to who the champion was in the first place. I mean, my God, some of the young people don't even remember. You had to wait until all the bowl games were played, and then a group of writers decided who won the national championship. They didn't even have a national championship game. That didn't come until later. It used to be you'd have the Rose Bowl and the Orange Bowl at night, and it was January 1st, and everything was all done. And then all of a sudden they go, yep, and guess what? The voters have decided that blah, blah, blah is the national champions of 1984. That's the way it used to be. So we're okay with that. Those who are screaming from the mountaintop that this should have never happened in the first place, look at all the cancellations. I think there's an understanding that if we don't get some of these games in, it's okay. Like, let's say LSU and Florida don't even play. Let's say it just can't be rescheduled for whatever reason. The Florida can still be properly evaluated, and LSU, I mean, they've got 2 losses, so they won't be. But Florida still can be properly evaluated. Especially if they go on to win the SEC East. Right? We're going to see this more and more, and I think college football, and I think the people that sort of cover college football and are still on board with this whole idea of we're playing through this. We're not overcoming it. We're just playing through this as much as we can. Need to really point this out. Because if you go to Twitter and it's all this doom and gloom about this should have never happened. And so many people are screaming to the heavens about what wrong we've done these players. This is silly. The players were the ones that were screaming. One of the reasons the Big Ten is going to play football this year, part of the reason, not all of it, but part of the reason was the outcry from the players and the parents of those players who said, don't take this away. So again, take all of this for what it is. It's just a sport trying to get through this. It's like everybody else. They can't be in a bubble. Nobody. We all can't boogie off to an island and put all these football teams in hotels. We have to play the hand the sport was dealt. And the hand was, these are student athletes. in college. You try to keep them out of classrooms. You try to keep everything as virtual as possible. You try to mask wearing and social distancing and all of those things, but there's still young people that are going to get this, and there's going to be outbreaks on teams. And you get through it, you test, you isolate the players that are positive, and you move on. Vanderbilt had that problem. Vanderbilt was down to 53 scholarship athletes, could not play against Missouri this weekend. The Missouri-Florida game is still in doubt for next weekend, not this coming weekend, but the 24th. Yeah, the Big Ten and the Pac-12 that are coming back pretty soon are going to be walking into this storm as well. What I'm worried about is the pundits who are screaming today, wait till the Big Ten has to cancel a bunch of games. You know, the one conference that started this whole we aren't playing in the summer and then backtracked when everybody else wouldn't follow suit except the Pac-12. When Michigan State and Wisconsin is postponed, Ohio State, Penn State is postponed, whatever, all these games in the Big Ten, when those start going down, you're going to start seeing people go, see, you should have led the charge. You should have gone with your conviction. You should have stayed the course. But the reality is we're going to get more games in than are going to be postponed or canceled outright. And because this sport is dictated from a bunch of people in a hotel ballroom anyway, we might as well just say, here's the resumes of everybody. You sort it out since you were going to do it in the first place. Now, one of the stories that is coming out about Florida was they were on the road at College Station over the weekend and lost to Texas A&M. And one of the factors Dan Mullen said, the head coach of the Gators, was that Texas A&M had a lot of people in the stands. I mean, they had a good crowd. Not one of these, hey, there's a group of people here and scattered over here and scattered over here. And boy, you can barely tell even people are here. No, they had a good crowd at Allen Field. But Mullen said, I'd like to pack the swamp. Because he saw it, right? He had a couple of things in his favor. One, he saw the effect of the crowd in the game, and he knew he wasn't getting that same sort of thing in Gainesville. Two, Governor Ron DeSantis at Florida was starting to open up the state a lot more and calling for stadiums to be filled up. So he took an advantage of the governor saying that stadiums can be filled up to say, hey, let's pack the swamp. Obviously, if it's okay, let's pack the swamp. Now, one thing about football guy is that I hope sometimes he's not football guy. I hope there is a secondary personality that kicks in, that you would preface all these kind of things with, hey, you know, only if it's safe, and I really am concerned about the student body, and I am concerned about our season ticket holders, especially the older ones that want to come out and see us play. I know we got to do this responsibly. Football guy can't always be, hey, man, let's get the stadium all packed and jacked so we can cheer on our football team to victory coming up on Saturday. You kind of want a guy to get to pull back a little bit. But remember, these guys, especially a Mullen, a Will Muschamp, and the younger, these guys, this is all they've dedicated so much of their life to this sport and the mentality of this sport. It is hard to separate a little bit. I want them to. Don't get me wrong. I want them to. This is not to excuse some of the silliness that some of these guys say about this virus and things like that. But it is hard for them to break away. You know, Mullen wants to win games. He's got a good football team. They gave up a lot of yards, but he can fix that. He's got a good football team. He's got a chance to win the East. He's got a chance to win the SEC. He's got a chance to play for a national championship. He doesn't want to let another game slip away from him. That game was winnable. They didn't win. Now he can't afford a second loss. Right? He can't afford two losses. Even in this crazy pandemic environment where we don't know how many games are getting in, he knows he can't lose another one. And he's got Georgia on the schedule, and he's got a sneaky good Tennessee team coming up, and he's got some other games on the schedule that will make you question, going, all right. So he's trying to say, look, if the opportunity allows itself, let's fill the stadium and let's give us a competitive edge at home. I saw it here right here in College Station. I want this same atmosphere for my players in Gainesville rather than 1,500 scattered around a 90,000-seat stadium. I don't blame him. But I also want him to realize, hey, let's not scream and holler about packed stadiums until we get this thing somewhat under control, and we're not really doing that yet. All right, on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, as we continue along with Wake Up Call.
listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. Home loans that fit your life. Rocket can.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, it's a throwback Thursday, 1988. This is Billy Ocean. Sean, who is taking care of the musical tunes today. Before your time, I'm assuming, right? 88? That's a good chunk of time ago.
8 years before I was born.
Right, okay. Could you... This song doesn't work today, right? Get into my car!
Hey, you!
You! Get into my car! No, I don't think it does. Sounded romantic at the time, right?
Because you think, like, drive-in movie theater... that kind of the more romanticized version of "Hey, you get in my car."
Right.
You don't think abduction scenario.
Like he's literally telling a woman, "I like you so much, get in my car."
Yeah,
you're in my dreams now. Get in my car.
Get out of my dreams. I don't want you.
Yeah, get out of my dreams. No more. Now I want you in the car. That's definitely not a 2020 song.
No, not at all.
Very aggressive.
And I don't think Billy Ocean is his real name.
There you go. All right, 88 World Series. Kirk Gibson hitting the home run of the ages in game number one. So just to set the scene, the Dodgers and the A's were in the World Series, and the A's were a powerful team. They had Mark McGwire, who hit 32 home runs that year. Jose Canseco hit 42. I mean, they were clearly the favorites in this World Series. The Dodgers, meanwhile, they didn't even have any real offensive, packed a punch. I mean, they didn't really have anything. I mean, Kirk Gibson had 25 home runs during the season, but the A's were leading 4-3 going into the bottom of the ninth inning. Dennis Eckersley, the car keys closer, when he came into the game, grabbed those car keys because the game was just about over. He was in, and Gibson, who had been dealing with a hamstring injury, and wasn't in the lineup. In fact, wasn't even in the dugout. Vin Scully pointed this out in the game. Wasn't even in the dugout. He was in the back getting some work done. He was hitting off of the tee. He was, he was in a lot of pain. But when they needed him, when Tommy Lasorda needed him, he said, well, get up there and go ahead and take a swing at Dennis Eckersley. And this is what happened.
And look who's coming up. To him to light the fire, and all year long he answered the demands until he was physically unable to start tonight with two bad legs, the bad left hamstring and the swollen right knee. And with two out, you talk about a roll of the dice. This is it. Sacks waiting on deck, but the game right now is at the plate. Fly ball into right field. She is gone.
That is the only thing Gibson could have done at that plate. Everything else would have been an out. Double to the corner? Nah, not a double into the corner. He would have been thrown out at first base. That's the only thing he could. It was home run or nothing. That was it. I mean, I'm not kidding. He could have hit one to left field in the corner and been thrown out at first base. I mean, he was hobbling. He was hobbling. But that was an absolute amazing moment. I mean, just the knee injury plus the hamstring injury, and he's up there just going to swing. And it's one thing, again, if he was going up against some rookie kid out of the pen, or maybe a guy 2 or 3 years in, had some trouble. He was going up against the best closer. He was going up against Dennis Eckersley. I mean, Eckersley was that automatic. And it set the tone for the series. Again, here was a Dodger team that was not favored in this series. Oakland was a better baseball team, and the Dodgers ended up winning it in five. And that was just game one. I mean, look, they came back and they won game two, and the A's took game three, and the Dodgers took the next two games. But Gibson never again batted in the series. He never participated again in the series. I mean, it's unbelievable. Joe Garagiola said they thought that he ran around the bases as if they were going to take it away from him. So that's 1988 on a throwback Thursday. as we continue. Those moments are great, though. I mean, listen, I grew up listening to Scully, or watching Scully, I should say, on baseball. I mean, Ron grew up listening to him on the radio. But to me, Vin Scully and Joe Graziella on NBC doing the World Series games, they were magical. I mean, they were some of the best, you know, moments of the 80s growing up watching the World Series. I mean, just game six of the World Series between the Mets and the Red Sox was... All I think about is Scully's call, about how quiet he was right after the ball went through Buckner's legs and everybody was going crazy. And it was kind of the same thing. He really let the moment happen. You know, the impossible happened, and just sort of let the moment fill the television screen of watching this guy limp around. So that is your throwback Thursday moment from 1988. That is my youth. That is, Sean's 8 years before he was born, but I go back to, you know, being in school. All these songs remind me of being a young kid in school. So it'll be kind of fun to go through that today. All right, as I mentioned earlier, the Florida Gators-LSU game has been postponed. Baylor's game against Oklahoma State has been postponed in college football. Last night, there was a really cool outcome, kind of cool in a way. If you're a Louisiana Raging Cajuns fan, not so much. Coastal Carolina upset the number 21 Louisiana Raging Cajuns in Lafayette yesterday. I know, who's Coastal Carolina? They have a coach who's making $1 a year. He was like some financer, just made a lot of money in banking and had a passion for football and was became a football coach, you know, knew the sport enough and became the head coach of the Coastal Carolina Chanticleers. And that was a nice upset win on the resume for the guy. And they pulled it up. Look, Louisiana's a good team. Billy Napier, who was once the offensive coordinator at Clemson about 10 years ago, is their head coach. He's going to be a Power 5 head coach someday. He's the coach of the Raging Cajuns. They have a pretty good team. Look, a lot of the rankings right now still have the teams that have not played yet. I mean, there are, if you look at the AP, for example, Ohio State is on it. You've got Oregon on it. Wisconsin is on it. These are teams who have yet to take the field. So Louisiana is holding its own by being in the top 25. When they weren't, you had a lot of teams on there that weren't going to be on there very long, but Louisiana was on there, and now they've suffered this loss. They had a close win this season that had people kind of questioning. I think it was against Georgia State. But last night, Coastal Carolina of Myrtle Beach, of Conway, South Carolina, near Myrtle Beach, pulls off the upset last night. But as I mentioned earlier, college football dealing with this pandemic, and we still got a good full season to go with two conferences who have yet to see the field. Nick Saban has got COVID. He is not going to be on the sidelines for the big game between Georgia and Alabama. Steve Sarkisian, who's had a really wild ride in his career, head coach at Washington, took over the USC program, then had some problems, some alcohol problems, and was let go of that job. He landed at Alabama. Then he landed at Atlanta. He was the offensive coordinator with the Falcons. He's back with Alabama and now, you know, helping Nick Saban with that offense. You know, we said this, I say this a lot. The coaching fraternity seems like it's big because there's a lot of coaches out there, but in reality, it's really small and everybody knows everybody. And the thing is, no matter what happens to you, we always hear people say, like, when a coach shows he can't coach and they go, oh, he'll never get a job again. No, they get jobs again. They always bounce. It doesn't matter what they do, unless it's really criminal. Guys always find their way back to the sport. It is a small group. It is a very small fraternity. You can find yourself on a coaching staff. Like, one of the exceptions to the rules was Art Briles, because he's so toxic and you really can't touch him for what went down at Baylor with all the sexual abuse scandals and him trying to cover that up. He's somebody that you really can't touch. But if you're not a good coach because your record, if you've been let go because the team underperformed, believe me, there are friends in the business that will get you on board. Steve Sarkisian has burned some bridges, but he's also built some bridges in his career. And now, if indeed he takes over as just as a interim head coach briefly for Saban, running the show for the Crimson Tide on the sidelines, it does fill a rather remarkable resume. You know, Lane Kiffin is in the same boat, right? I mean, Lane Kiffin was a 32-year-old coach of the Raiders, for crying out loud. I mean, he was an NFL head coach at a very, very early age, and he burnt that bridge with the late Al Davis, but he landed at Tennessee, and then he left for USC. Then he found his way to Alabama as an assistant, went down to Florida Atlantic and chilled out for a bit, but he had the Owls winning games, and now he's back in the SEC with Ole Miss. Guys find their way back into it. I just think it's fascinating with Sarkisian, because, man, they really had some problems with him at USC. But again, when you get your act together, you can find yourself getting jobs. He was with the Atlanta Falcons. Remember that? It was in the NFL. And now he's on maybe on the sideline for Nick Saban while he's quarantined with COVID. By the way, Saban says he's doing well, so keep an eye on thoughts to him and his family as they go through it. All right, coming up next, we'll get into the NFL as this weekend is full of games. And one that was supposed to take place but didn't take place, and I'm kind of glad that it is, that it did get canceled. That's coming up next as we continue with Wake Up Call.
SportsNap Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Ron Culver out today as he is in going out to California for a wedding. I am at an age, I hate to say this because it's going to sound really selfish, but I wonder how many of you agree with me. I'm kind of at an age where I don't want to go to weddings anymore. Like if my sister gets married, I will go, of course. Immediate family, of course. But unless it's local, I don't want to travel for a wedding. I'm kind of done with weddings and those. I don't know why. My wife, of course, will drag me to any wedding that anybody's having, right? Oh, let's go to Mississippi. A buddy of yours is getting, she'll drag me to every wedding. But I don't like going. I don't know why. I want to celebrate. It's a great moment. It's a great time. You have a great party afterwards, right? The receptions can be a blast. The last wedding I went to was in 2015, and it was an open bar, and the hotel was like right across the street from the reception center. So I had a really good time because I don't get to let loose very often. But I don't know what it is. It just doesn't make me. I go, I'm not going. No, I don't want to go that weekend. But oh, nevertheless, so I give him a lot of credit for traveling during this time to go to his brother's wedding. Well done. Well done. All right, so the Denver Broncos and the New England Patriots were scheduled to play last Sunday. Then with COVID, they got it moved to Monday. And everyone was like, okay, it'll be a doubleheader on Monday night. But once again, there was a positive test within the Patriots organization. Stephon Gilmore, I think, tested positive. And the NFL said, okay, you guys aren't playing on Sunday and you guys ain't playing on Monday. We're going to be moving your game to the following weekend. And then we're going to do some shuffling around with your opponents. And we're going to get you back a kind of a different schedule, especially you, Denver, because we're going to move your game that you were supposed to play this weekend to another week and then that week to another week. So we've shuffled your schedule around a little bit to accommodate this game. But I'm kind of glad they did. What we were scheduled to get Monday night, I'm just going to leave it at Monday night, even though it was supposed to be Sunday. Monday night was Brett Rypien against Brian Hoyer / Jarrett Stidham. That's what we were going to get. And instead, we'll get Cam Newton and Drew Locke. It looks like both of those quarterbacks are going to play. Now, Cam Newton is supposed to report today. We'll get a feeling for that as days and time progresses as to if he's going to be ready. But the Broncos look like Drew Locke is coming back from his shoulder injury and should be ready to go. Look, one of the problems in the NFL, unfortunately, is the quarterback play as a whole, 32 teams, is not up to par. There are teams with lousy quarterbacks. There are teams with exceptional Hall of Fame. You'll never forget them quarterbacks. But the backup quarterback situation is weak. No one is excited about any backup quarterback out there. Even Andy Dalton, who had a pretty good career in Cincinnati, not a terrible career, and taking over for Dak Prescott. Look, Andy Dalton was an NFL starter for a long time. Actually had the Bengals good, right, at a couple of times in his career. And immediately, when Prescott went down, instead of saying, you know, Andy Dalton might be able to keep this ship afloat, like in a weak division, he's not going to lead them to some 11-5, 12-4 record, but in a weak division, Andy Dalton is not bad to go in there and be your quarterback. Instead, the cry was, the season is over. If season is over with an 0-5 team, a 1-4 team, and a 1-3-1 team, the season is over because Andy Dalton is going to be your starting quarterback. That's all you need to know about the backup quarterback situation in this league. Joe Flacco won a Super Bowl, and nobody thinks the Jets will win a game. And he's just kind of subbing in for Sam Darnold. That's how bad the backup quarterback situation is. Drew Lock against Cam Newton. Even though the Broncos aren't a good football team at 1-3, the Patriots at 2-2 need to kind of, you know, keep going and keep pace with the Bills in the division. That's a better way to watch that game than Brett Rippon against Jarrett Stidham. And I like Jarrett Stidham, but I don't like him over Cam Newton. So in a way, we got a bonus because if you are stuck with that game this weekend or watching it in whatever capacity, or you're a fan of either team, you got at least a better matchup because of COVID. That's not always going to be the case, but in this particular case, it is. And what I'm glad for it. I'm glad Cam Newton is okay. I'm glad he's reporting to the facility today. We're going to talk to Jonathan Stewart, former Panthers running back, coming up next hour. But he's retired. Him and D'Angelo Williams with a 1-2 punch for the Panthers. And we'll talk to him about Cam's resurgence with the Patriots. But that's better. That's a better quarterback matchup. It is a Throwback Thursday, 1988. Kurt Gibson's home run is what we're focusing on for that. We continue with Wake Up Call.